The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine dated August 24th through August 31st. 2012. We'll begin with the main story section, as usual, here in our weekly reading of the week. Our first article here is entitled, By Picking Ryan, Romney Shakes Up the Race. Mitt Romney upended the presidential race this past week by picking hardline fiscal conservative Paul Ryan as his running mate, turning the November election into a choice between starkly contrasting ideologies on spending, taxes, and the role of government. Ryan, a Catholic congressman from Wisconsin, is best known as the author of a budget blueprint for the Republican-led House of Representatives that would slash private and corporate taxes, make deep cuts in programs for the poor, and, beginning in 10 years, try to rein in Medicare costs by giving seniors vouchers to buy private health insurance. Romney hailed Ryan as an intellectual leader of the Republican Party and praised his ability to work with members of both parties to find common ground. Ryan said his deep familiarity with Capitol Hill and federal budgets would complement Romney's business credentials and help Republicans turn around the economy. "We won't duck the tough issues," he said. "We will lead." Democrats wasted little time in attacking Ryan as a right-wing extremist. Representative Chris Van Hollen, senior Democrat on the House Budget Committee, said Ryan's proposals represented Bush trickle-down economics on steroids. A Gallup poll found that 42% rated Ryan's selection as fair or poor, while 39% called it excellent or good. That was the least positive reception for a vice presidential pick since Dan Quayle in 1988. Now here's what the editorials had to say. Paul Ryan is a welcome addition to the 2012 race, said the Washington Post. The Wisconsin congressman is a one-man idea factory whose serious, if flawed, proposals on taxes and entitlements will turn what has been a dismally substance-free campaign into a serious clash of ideas. Romney's decision says good things about his candidacy, said NationalReview.com. By choosing a full-spectrum conservative as a running mate, he has committed himself to a bold conservative agenda. That will mean fierce fights on Medicare, welfare reform, and tax policy. But these are debates worth winning, and they can be won. Now here's what the columnist had to say. Romney had much safer choices, said Nate Silver in NYTimes.com. So it's fair to assume he felt he was losing and needed to shake up the race. Ryan will energize the conservative base, but his impact on centrist swing voters is questionable at best. Ryan is the flesh and blood embodiment of the most unpopular Congress in history, and he's far to the right of most independents. Ryan, in fact, represents an even bigger political gamble than the selection of Sarah Palin 4 years ago, said Jay Bookman in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Democrats will hang his proposal to privatize Medicare around the Romney ticket's neck like a huge albatross. In not-for-attribution interviews, Republican political strategists quickly expressed deep doubt, even panic, about the choice, saying Ryan could cost Republicans not only any chance at the White House, but seats in the House and Senate as well. It could put the Senate out of reach, one GOP strategist told The Hill. This is not good. Don't be so sure, said Jim Tankersley in NationalJournal.com. Ryan neutralizes Obama's class war argument by reframing the election as a choice between Republicans who want to encourage individual responsibility and cut taxes, and a president who wants to funnel hard-earned middle-class tax dollars to the poor. Ryan also can convince Americans that a vote for Obama is a vote for economic disaster, said Fred Barnes in WeeklyStandard.com. He has the personal charisma and policy chops to make the impending deficit crisis real in voters' minds. Say this about Paul Ryan, said Jacob Weisberg in Slate.com. He's a conviction politician who understands the hard choices ahead and would end the Republican practice of calling for less government in theory while voting for more in practice. His proposal to turn Medicare into a voucher system puts the onus on Democrats to say how else they would restrain a program that is growing to consume the entire federal budget. But he won't be rewarded for his boldness in Florida, a must-win state for Romney, or in other swing states with lots of seniors. Ryan's selection represents a big step in the direction of conservative honesty and probably for that reason toward Republican defeat. The next article from the main story section is entitled War Talk in Israel. Speculation that Israel might soon attack Iran's nuclear facilities reached a fever pitch in Israeli newspapers this past week amid reports that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants to launch strikes before the U.S. election. Netanyahu, Israeli media reports said, believes that U.S. and international sanctions have failed and that Iran's progress toward a nuclear weapon has accelerated. By attacking before November, sources said he believes he'll leave President Obama with no choice but to publicly support Israel's offensive. Netanyahu fueled the rumors by appointing a new civil defense minister, which many interpreted as a sign that Israel is preparing for retaliatory strikes. The government also stepped up the distribution of gas masks and tested a nationwide text message system that would alert the public in the event of missile attacks. Netanyahu told his cabinet that the possibility of an Iranian bomb dwarfs all others' threats to Israel. Public support is growing for a strike because they are increasingly convinced by Netanyahu that it is either an attack or Auschwitz, said Yoram Maital, chairman of Ben-Gurion University's Herzog Center for Middle East Studies. This is nothing more than irresponsible psychological warfare, said Avi Iskaroff in Haaretz in Israel. It's difficult to know what Netanyahu and Defense Minister Ehud Barak, the chief saber-rattlers for striking Iran, expect to accomplish with these media leaks. But they know that neither the Israeli defense establishment nor most Israelis want this war. Our bombs will only succeed in delaying Iran's nuclear project by a year at most. A war with Iran would be a costly disaster, said Nehemiah Strassler, also in Haaretz. It would bring hundreds of Iranian and Hezbollah rockets raining down on Israeli cities and paralyze our economy. Global oil prices would spike, making us even less popular in Europe and the U.S. than we already are. Taking action against Iran obviously involves major risks, said Giora Island and Yedioth Aharonov in Israel. But the same is also correct in not acting. Washington may not want us to strike, but time is running out. But backing President Obama into a corner before the election would be outrageously cynical, said the New York Times in an editorial. There is no evidence that Iran is on the verge of making a weapon, and with the toughest sanctions having just gone into effect last month, there is still time for intensified diplomacy. Israeli leaders should end this loose talk of war. Our next article is entitled A Civilian Takeover in Egypt. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi forced out two of the country's top generals this past week in a bold attempt to wrest power from the junta that has dominated Egypt since the overthrow of dictator Hosni Mubarak. Taking advantage of a military debacle on the Sinai Peninsula, where jihadists killed 16 Egyptian border guards, Morsi ordered the retirement of Field Marshal Mohamed Hussein Tatawi, the country's defense minister and de facto ruler since last year's revolution, and General Sami Inan, the army's chief of staff. Morsi, a former leader of the Muslim Brotherhood and Egypt's first democratically elected president, also tore up a military decree that had stripped his office of many of its powers. Egyptians may have a chance for democracy after all, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. Since Mubarak's fall, his former military henchmen have done all they can to thwart the transition to civilian rule. The generals had the democratically elected parliament dismissed and then tried to gut the presidency. But Morsi refused to cede one of the signal victories of the Arab Spring and ordered parliament reinstated last month. Now, by removing the senior generals, he has established control of the government by a democratically chosen civilian, himself. But what will he do with that power? Asked Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. The Obama administration saw the military as an effective check on the Brotherhood, but it underestimated the Brotherhood's will to come out on top. Thanks to Morsi's power play, anti-Western Islamists can now take control over every sector of Egyptian society and government. Don't overestimate the Brotherhood's reach, said Dan Murphy in CSMonitor.com. Other military figures, eager to find scapegoats for the Sinai disaster, likely approve the firing of Tantawi and Inan. Yes, this maneuver strengthens the president's hand. But given the country's perilous financial position and the military's tenacious influence, it's far from clear how long that position of strength will last. And now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. This week is again about Paul Ryan. Is his budget plan extremist? It's official, compassionate conservatism is dead, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. By picking House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan as his running mate, Mitt Romney has surrendered to the Tea Party Rush Limbaugh wing of the Republican Party, entrusting his budget and fiscal power, or fiscal policy, to a power-pointing, wielding young gun who's become the GOP's ideological leader in Congress. Clean-cut, relentlessly fit, with an Irish altar boy's widow's peak and droopy, winsome blue eyes, Ryan may be the cutest package cruelty ever came in. His Path to Prosperity budget blueprint would give massive tax breaks to the wealthy, said Katrina Vanden Heuvel in the Washington Post, while forcing those on food stamps, Medicaid, and other social service programs to absorb a stunning 60% of his spending cuts. He'd help pay for tax cuts for millionaires like Romney by turning Medicare into a voucher program that puts seniors at the mercy of private insurance companies. It's a thoroughly heartless vision, but exactly what you'd expect from a man who says he was inspired to enter politics by libertarian heroine Ayn Rand, who praised selfishness as a virtue and disdained the useless parasites and moochers who live off successful capitalists' tax dollars. Ryan is no radical, said Michael Gerson in WashingtonPost.com, and he frightens liberals because his vision of government is so persuasive. A true budget and policy wonk, he's developed a detailed, thoroughly modern conservative approach to governing, one that will shrink our Leviathan government, stimulate economic growth, and pull the country out of the ditch. Democrats insist Ryan wants to do away with Medicare, said Avik Roy in Forbes.com, but it just isn't true. His latest budget, the one Romney endorsed, not only keeps Medicare as it is for everyone currently over 55, but gives future seniors the option of either staying in Medicare or switching to the new voucher system. What that means, however, is that Ryan would do nothing to curb Medicare spending for a full decade, said Matt Miller in the Washington Post. Meanwhile, his tax cuts, which would be added to the Bush tax cuts, would balloon the deficit by another $6 trillion in the same period. In the rosiest of scenarios, his plan doesn't balance the budget until 2030. So please let's not call Ryan a fiscal conservative, serious, or a truth teller. The man's a supply-side zealot who would shred the social safety net to put more money in the pockets of the very rich. On social issues, Ryan's even more extreme, said Michelle Goldberg in the DailyBeast.com, with a voting record indistinguishable from that of the rabid Representative Michelle Bachmann. Ryan would ban abortion even in cases of rape and incest and co-sponsored a bill that defined fertilized eggs as human beings. Ultimately, Ryan's hard right positions on social issues may end up alienating as many voters as his budget plans. Let the voters decide if Ryan's an extremist, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Now that he's front and center, people will find he's fearless, has total mastery of the policy choices facing us, and possesses a sunny demeanor like that of Ronald Reagan, whom liberals also once denounced as a radical. Still, Romney has taken an enormous risk by tying his fate to Ryan's vision of a downsized government, said Molly Ball in the Atlantic.com. But the choice carries one big advantage. The Ryan budget's most credible defender will be on stage with Romney, ready and willing to take the heat. Now, from the controversy of the week, we'll turn to the popular column, A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for interspecies cooperation after three kangaroos escaped from a German zoo with the help of a fox and a wild boar. The roos got free of their pen through a hole dug by the fox, then breached the zoo's exterior fence through a hole that was dug by the wild boar. It was a good week for conspiracy theorists after the first photos of the Martian landscape sent back by NASA's Curiosity rover looked a lot like Nevada and Utah. You would really be forgiven for thinking that NASA was trying to pull a fast one on you, said a project scientist. And it was a good week for strip clubs in Tampa, which are gearing up for a surge in business during the upcoming Republican convention. Club owner Don Kleinhand says he's been told to expect two to three times what a Super Bowl would be. While Scarlett's in Ybor City invited conventioners to come, party like a liberal. And it was a bad week for Phoenix, which was broiled in a record-setting, skin-searing heat wave that saw nine straight daily highs over 110 degrees, including highs of 114 and even 116. It was a bad week for Mississippi after recent data showed that the state is the fattest in the U.S. for the sixth year in a row. Louisiana and West Virginia were close behind, while Colorado rated as the skinniest state. And it was a bad week for the dead man's float after a passerby spotted a body face up in Pennsylvania's Susquehanna River. As a police forensic team approached, the body startled them by sitting up in the water. "I didn't mean to worry anyone," said Joseph D'Angelo, who'd been wearing a life jacket and enjoyed a nice, quiet float. And now we'll move on to the People section from the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled Ferrell's Funny Romance. It took Will Ferrell a long time to find love, said Holly Malaya in Elle magazine. As a student at the University of Southern California, he struggled to find a girlfriend. The funny guy doesn't get the girl until later in life, the comedian says. In high school, college, everyone still wants the brooding, dangerous guy you shouldn't have. After graduating, Ferrell moved home to Irvine, California, where he met a blonde and brainy Swede named Viveka Paulin. They briefly dated, stayed friendly, and then Ferrell moved to New York to join the cast of Saturday Night Live. Viv and I would talk as friends for 2 hours, and it would feel like 5 minutes. For me, Viv was the one that got away. But she didn't. When Ferrell visited Los Angeles, Paulin invited him over for a drink. She drank her beer in two sips, just pounded it. And then she said, "I think I still like you." I didn't play it cool at all. I went. "I just told my uncle that I'm going to marry you one day. The couple wed in 2000, and they now have 3 sons. What I love most about Viv is simple. She totally got my sense of humor. I sent her flowers every day for a week with a card like, "You're the 5th prettiest woman in the office." She loved it. The next article is The Ballerina Who Survived a Civil War. Mikola de Prince went from the war orphan to a ballet star, said David Smith in The Guardian in the UK. Born in 1995 during Sierra Leone's bloody civil war, de Prince was 3 years old when rebels killed her father. A week later, her mother died of starvation and de Prince was placed in an orphanage. There was no escape from the horrors. Rebels raided the building, killing her pregnant teacher. They cut her arms and legs off, says the 17-year-old. I tried to save her. The caregivers at the orphanage despised de Prince because of her independent spirit. We were ranked as numbers, and my number, 27, was the least favorite, so I got the least amount of food. Her only source of hope was a photograph of an American ballerina she found in a discarded magazine. She looked really happy. I wanted to become this person. De Prince got to realize that dream in 1999 when she was adopted by an American couple who enrolled her in a top New York City ballet school. She now faces a new obstacle, her race, and says she is often turned down for roles for being too dark. But de Prince, who recently made her professional debut in a production of Le Corsaire, refuses to be held back by prejudice. Because I've been through so much, I know that I can make it. And the next article from the People section, Danes, Solitary Youth. Claire Dane spent her teen years terrified of other kids, said Stuart McGurk in GQ in the UK. Her fear started in junior high, where she was viciously bullied by a fellow student. There was one girl who would get very excited about the idea of torturing me, says the 33-year-old actress. It was just agony. I developed a real phobia of people my age. Girls especially. At age 14, she was cast in the TV show My So-Called Life and was so lonely that she would just sit on a sidewalk and look at other teenagers. Her solitary existence ended at age 16 when a production assistant befriended her on a movie set. She became a big sister and a wonderfully corrupting influence. She slapped me around a bit and really encouraged me to get stupid. In 1998, Danes took a break from acting and went to Yale, where she did all the rebellious things, getting drunk and partying, that she'd missed out on as a teenager. Danes only stayed 2 years, but says they were important ones for her. I could have gone through life thinking that women were just these venomous creatures. Turns out, they're not. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. We'll turn now to the briefing section. It's entitled, Courting the Latino Voter. In 2008, Hispanic voters helped make Barack Obama president. Will they now save his re-election campaign? How important is the Latino vote in 2012? It could be decisive. The boom in the Latino population from 35 million in 2000 to over 50 million today has been especially pronounced in 5 key swing states: Florida, Colorado, Nevada, North Carolina, and Virginia. The Latino vote is almost certain to tilt heavily Democratic, but the size of the margin could mean the difference between victory and defeat for President Obama and his Republican opponent, Mitt Romney. That's why both campaigns are wooing Hispanic voters. Obama's decision in June to halt the deportations of young immigrants illegally brought to the U.S. as children was widely seen as an attempt to please Hispanic voters, as was Romney's pledge to overhaul the green card system to allow immigrants to more easily keep their families together. But despite all the attention to Latino voters, there are real doubts that a majority of them will show up at the polls. Why is that? Well, Americans of Latin American descent represent the fastest growing demographic in the U.S., but the number of Latino voters isn't rising as quickly. Just under half of eligible Latino voters turned out to vote in 2008, compared with 66% of whites and 65% of blacks. And voter enthusiasm among Latinos is not going down, or rather, excuse me, it is going down, not up. Hispanic voter registration actually fell from 11.6 million in 2008 to 10.9 million in 2010 and has shown few signs of picking up this year, even though the total number of eligible Latino voters has climbed to 21.7 million. We still need to confront a registration gap that is quite significant, said University of Washington political scientist Matt Barreto. What's the reason for that gap? It's at least partly the result of the recessions hitting Latinos disproportionately hard. Median household wealth among Hispanics plummeted 66% between 2005 and 2009, and Latino homeowners have suffered a foreclosure rate of 11.9%, more than twice that of whites. When people lose their jobs or homes, they usually have to move elsewhere, said Antonio Gonzalez, who is the head of Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. When you move, you have to re-register, and we suspect that didn't happen in 2009 and 10. In addition, almost a third of eligible Hispanic voters are under 30, a demographic group with lower engagement across the board. In 2010, just 17.6% of young Latinos actually voted. Can turnout be improved? The Democrats have long pushed get-out-the-vote campaigns among Latinos, but now Republicans have recognized that they have to get serious about courting Hispanic voters, too. They face a challenging trend. George W. Bush captured 40% of this Hispanic vote in 2004, but John McCain got only 31% in 2008. And this year, polls indicate that Obama is crushing Romney among Hispanics, 67% to 23%. Since Latinos are projected to make up nearly 30% of the U.S. population by 2050, the Republican Party will be unable to win national elections if it does not bring more of them under its tent. Can Republicans make that happen? In the long term, it's possible. Hispanics tend to skew conservative on many issues that define Republican voters, such as opposition to abortion, gay rights, and organized labor. But in recent years, the GOP's often harsh rhetoric about illegal immigration has turned off Latino voters. During the primary season, Romney moved right on immigration, vowing to block illegal immigrants from getting jobs and benefits so they'd self-deport. He also promised to veto the DREAM Act, which would allow many children of illegal immigrants to apply for U.S. citizenship. Romney has dug himself into a great big hole with Latinos on immigration, said Anna Navarro, an advisor to John McCain in 2008. That hole got deeper when Obama issued the executive order ending deportations of illegal immigrants who arrived as minors and offering them a chance to stay in the U.S. permanently. So Hispanics will back Obama? Yes, but the question is whether the lopsided poll numbers will hold up on Election Day. Unemployment among Latinos is 10.3%. Many Latino leaders have strongly criticized Obama for failing to craft a national immigration policy and for deporting a record 1.4 million illegal immigrants. With many white voters deserting, the Democrats' analysts say Obama cannot win if his share of the Hispanic vote drops below 65%. Romney hopes to chip away at Obama's Hispanic support, especially among Cuban Americans in the swing state of Florida. The Obama campaign, meanwhile, is counting on Hispanic voters to deliver two other critical swing states, Nevada and Colorado. All they need is to be inspired, said Armando Navarro, a political scientist at the University of California, Riverside. We are truly the balance of power. We are the swing vote. Battling for El Corazon of Texas. Nowhere is the Latino vote more significant in the long term than in Texas, where the Latino population has grown by 3 million in the past 10 years, and one in three residents is now Hispanic. Republican presidential candidates have won this deep red state in every election since 1976, but unless the party can improve its share of the Latino vote, Texas could turn blue within a decade. Fortunately for the GOP, it now has a rising Hispanic star in Texas, Ted Cruz, a Cuban-American attorney who was swept to victory in last month's U.S. Senate primary on a wave of Tea Party support. If he wins in November, Cruz could play a major role in attracting conservative-minded Latinos to the GOP. But Texas Democrats see a future just as promising for Julian Castro, the 37-year-old mayor of San Antonio, who has been tapped to give the keynote speech at the Democratic National Convention in September. Cruz and Castro, said Dallas Morning News columnist Wayne Slater, represent the radically different poles that will divide and will define our politics for the next generation. Now, from the Week magazine, we'll turn to a reading of the best columns in the U.S. for this past week, as deemed by the Week magazine editors. The first one is entitled, Romney's Silence on His Faith, by Ross Dutat in the New York Times. Mitt Romney, the candidate, is often dismissed as hollow, cynical, and inauthentic, said Ross Dutat. But Romney, the man who does have deep convictions rooted in his intense lifelong commitment to his Mormon faith. Unfortunately, the Republican nominee has been unwilling to talk about his religion, leaving much of his biography and character unknown to voters. If Romney were a Presbyterian, Methodist, or Jew, his dedication to his religious community as a lay bishop, his philanthropy, and his selfless works of charity to friends and fellow Mormons in trouble would all be woven into a political narrative that emphasized his piety and decency. But if he puts his faith on the table, he'd have to address some uncomfortable aspects of Mormon history, including its founders' polygamy and racism, and Chief Prophet Joseph Smith's odd revelations, including his revisions of the Bible and his assertion that Jesus once visited America, all of which can make his faith seem alien. The price for Romney's silence, however, is that he's cut himself off from things that make his life short, his life story impressive, and has shielded voters from the deepest longings of his heart. The next column is entitled Defining Ryan on Wikipedia by Megan Garber in TheAtlantic.com. The moment Paul Ryan was announced as Mitt Romney's running mate, the Wikipedia wars began, said Megan Garber. If you looked at the right moment, you might discover from Ryan's Wikipedia entry that in high school, his classmates voted him the biggest brown noser. Conservative supporters quickly deleted all mentions of brown noser from the publicly edited site, claiming it was irrelevant to Ryan's life story. His opponents then reinserted the gossipy tidbit because relevant. As of this writing, Brown Noser has been pulled again, but that equilibrium could change again in an instant. In recent days, Ryan's biography was re-edited hundreds of times by partisans and campaign operatives. No surprise there. The virtual battle to define candidates via their Wikipedia entries is now an established part of American political campaigns. Sarah Palin's Wikipedia entry, for instance, was updated at least 68 times the day before John McCain announced her selection. All this editing may seem silly, but Wikipedia and the web itself has become a town square for the digital age. That means plenty of partisan bickering and plenty of dissent and derision. And our third column for the Week magazine this week is entitled Conservatives Needed on Climate Crisis by Fred Krupp in the Wall Street Journal. With Americans enduring the hottest summer in more than a century, said Fred Krupp, some conservatives are beginning to warm to the reality of climate change. Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey and Governor John Kasich of Ohio are among those who have recently conceded that the climate is getting hotter and wilder. It's a welcome turning point. For too long, progress on climate change has been stuck in an ideological logjam. Conservatives stubbornly insisted that climate change was a scam pushed by liberals to justify government control over the economy. Scornful liberals, meanwhile, demanded massive and unrealistic cutbacks in greenhouse gas emissions. Today, as rising sea levels are flooding some coastal communities and withering heat is incinerating crops, conservatives must face the reality that ignoring climate change will have grave economic consequences. Their voices and ideas are needed in crafting a realistic bipartisan response. We cannot ignore the economic impact of any plan to reduce fossil fuel use. For any policy to succeed, it must work with the market, not against it. Now, from the Week magazine, we will flip to the back of the magazine here for the article entitled The Last Word. This week, the specific article for the Last Word column here is called Hearing the Voice of God. Anthropologist Tanya Luhrmann, says Jill Wolfson, studies how evangelicals experience their connection to Jesus. On a Sunday evening in Palo Alto, California, around 50 members of the Vineyard Christian Fellowship of the Peninsula gathered in a rented room above a popular coffee shop. Before the occasion got underway, the conversation was a friendly and exuberant mix of the mundane and the heady. The gorgeous weather, Christian writer C.S. Lewis, the lusciousness of the strawberry set out as a new snack, someone's car trouble, the problem of demons. Lead pastor Alex Van Rysen, a tall, informal, open-faced man, got everyone settled and quiet. For those of you who haven't been to our church, this is the way it is, Van Rysen began cheerfully. Everyone hangs outside eating, drinking coffee, and talking. Then, when you hear the voice of God, you come inside. There was a burst of laughter, an evangelical joke for an evangelical Christian audience. Van Rysen then segued to the main event. Have people been asking you about the book? He asked the group. I've been getting lots of email about it. The book in question, When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God, is about the people in this very room. On the makeshift stage next to Van Rysen sat its author, Tanya Luhrmann, who spent 2 years studying this Vineyard church and another 2 years at a Vineyard church in Chicago. She knows these believers well. Luhrmann attended Sunday church, where members dance, swayed, cried, and raised their hands as a sign of surrender to God. She attended weekly home prayer groups, whose members reportedly hearing God communicate to them directly. She hung out, participated, took notes, recorded interviews, and tried to understand, as an outsider, how an insider to this evangelical world was able to experience God as real and personal and intimate. Members told her about having coffee with God, seeing angel wings, and getting God's advice on everything from job choice to what shampoo to buy. After being introduced jokingly by Van Rysen as Professor Luhrmann to people who have known her for so long as Tanya, she told the group her book does not weigh in on the actual existence of God. Rather, her research focuses on theory of mind, how we conceptualize our minds and those of others. In this case, she investigated how the practice of prayer can train a person to hear what they determine to be God's voice. I do think that if God does speak to someone, God speaks through the human mind, she explained. As an anthropologist, I feel I can say something about the social, cultural, and psychological features of what that person is experiencing. I came into this project wanting to understand the question, how are rational, sensible, educated people able to sustain faith in an invisible being in an environment of skepticism? Luhrmann's provocative theory is that the church teaches those who pray to use their minds differently than they do in everyday life. They begin by holding conversations with God in their heads, modeled on the kind of chummy conversations they'd have with their best friends. As they talk to him, tell him about their problems, and imagine his wise counsel and loving response, they are training their thoughts, much as people use weights to train their muscles. The church encourages them to tune into sounds, images, and feelings that are louder or more intense or more unfamiliar or more powerful, and to interpret these internal cues as the external voice of God. I came in with a set of stereotypes of evangelicals, the kind that you'd expect from someone in the academy, she said. I came out with more respect for the religious process, how private and precious the experience of God can be for people. She read from her book's final chapter, "I have said that I do not presume to know ultimate reality, but it is also true that through the process of this journey, in my own way, I have come to know God." Luhrmann's work has roots deep in her intellectual and emotional past. She describes herself as an anthropologist with one foot in psychology. She could easily add that her other foot is in theology and both hands have a firm grasp on philosophy. Her upbringing was that of a spiritual mutt. In the book's preface and acknowledgments, she writes that she has been thinking about God ever since her maternal grandmother, a Baptist minister, walked across the park with me when I was 6 and tried to explain who he thought God was. His daughter, Luhrmann's mother, took her children to the more free-form Unitarian Church. Luhrmann's paternal grandfather was a Christian scientist whose son, Luhrmann's father, became a medical doctor, a psychiatrist. The eldest of 3 children, Tanya, was raised in a suburban New Jersey neighborhood where she helped Orthodox Jewish neighbors as a Shabbaskoy, a Gentile who assists with activities that are restricted on the Sabbath, such as turning on light switches. I came from this background where I knew smart, good people whom I loved, but who came down on very different positions on the existence of God, not only on the yes-no dimension, but on who God was. As a Harvard freshman, she had thoughts about Immanuel Kant that in many ways set the course of her career. She decided that the philosopher was cheating when he explained away the irrational. I've always been intrigued by myths and stories and the way people construct their world. People live in the narrative, and that is more important than their logical sensibility in many ways. So I switched from philosophy to folklore. I was just so curious about people and about the way they come to hold their beliefs, even in the face of evidence to the contrary. An academic mentor encouraged her to pursue graduate studies at the University of Chicago, but a chance encounter with a volume in the Harvard bookstore sent her in a different direction. It was a book that told you how to be a witch, she recalls with a laugh. I was amazed by this. You can learn that? She headed to Cambridge University for graduate studies, from whence she could go hang out in London with all these pagans and magicians, for the most part educated and middle-class people, and plunge into this really batty dissertation on modern witches. The goal was not to rule on the validity of magic. Luhrmann was more interested in the magical process, in what happened in the minds of the practitioners. I was really taken by my observation that something does happen. I didn't quite know how to think about it, but they experienced something directly. Luhrmann did what anthropologists do and participated in their world by joining their groups, reading their books, and performing rituals. For 30 minutes a day, for 9 months, she practiced seeing with her mind's eye, following instructions such as build up in imagination a journey from your physical plane home to your ideal room. What startled her was that her witchcraft self-training worked. Her internal awareness seemed to shift. Her senses felt more alive and alert. She had her own supernatural experience. One night after she'd done some pleasurable and immersive reading about the early Celts, or Celts rather, six Druids appeared outside her window and just suddenly vanished. Had they been there in the flesh? I thought not, she writes in When God Talks Back, but the vivid singular experience led her to wonder for many years if something about the practice associated with magic made these supernatural experiences more common. When I encountered the same spiritual techniques in experiential evangelical Christianity, I was determined to find out. In 2007, to better understand if and how spiritual practice impacts the mind, Luhrmann randomly divided Christian volunteers into groups. One listened on iPods for 30 minutes a day to lectures on the Gospels, while another participated in a more interactive, imagination-rich way similar to the prayer style of Vineyard members. Their recordings invited them to see, hear, and touch God in the mind's eye, to carry on a dialogue with Jesus. I found that after a month of prayer practice, people reported more vivid mental imagery than those who listened to the lectures, she says. They used mental imagery more readily and had somewhat better perceptual attention, and they reported more unusual sensory experience. In short, they attended to their inner experience more seriously, and that altered how real that experience became for them. The night before Luhrmann appeared at the Vineyard congregation, she read and answered questions at a Bay Area bookstore. She traced the modern history of the evangelical movement from its hippie, Jesus-freak roots of the 1960s to its current mostly conservative, mostly middle-class state. She talked about the people whose stories give the book its narrative pull, people whose faith proved more complex than she had imagined. This was an entirely different crowd. A couple of atheists ranted about how people who talk to God must be nuts. Another person in the audience, a little more measured, wanted Luhrmann to address the impact that conservative evangelicals are having on the country's political landscape. It is not a small impact. Of the many baby boomers who once stopped going to churches, half have returned to religious practices, but not to the mainstream services of their childhood. They have flocked to churches similar to the Vineyard. A recent study found that nearly 40% of Americans said that the main reason they practice religion was to forge a personal relationship with God. Some call this movement the country's fourth great awakening, a reference to other eras in American history in which religious fervor shaped the national agenda. While Luhrmann intentionally avoided politics in the book, it comes up in interviews and reviews as readers and critics wonder if the author ever engaged her subjects in a lively conversation about gay marriage or evolution. Her answer is that conservative evangelicals and secular liberals are at such odds politically because they think about life very differently. If political progressives really want to stop scratching their heads over why evangelicals get so upset about same-sex marriage and health care reform, they need to understand how evangelicals think about God. Secular liberals want to create the social conditions that allow everyday people behaving the way ordinary people behave to have fewer bad outcomes, she says. When evangelicals vote, they think more immediately about what kind of person they are trying to become, what humans could and should be, rather than who they are. From this perspective, the problem with government is that it steps in when people fall short. Hanging out with believers, whom she found smarter and more varied than many liberals realize, has given her some insight that could double as political advice. If Democrats want to reach more evangelical voters, they should use a political language that evangelicals can hear. They should talk about the kind of people we are aiming to be and about the transformational journey that any choice will take us. And that was reprinted with permission from Stanford Magazine, published by the Stanford Alumni Association of Stanford University. Thank you. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled The 2012 Olympics, A Triumph for Women. Move over Michael Phelps and Usain Bolt, said Bill Soperito in Time. This summer, the women of the Olympics changed everything. Just 16 years after 26 nations still refused to send women to the Olympics, a record 44% of the athletes were female, and they gave us some of the game's most compelling moments. China's Ye Shiwen shattered the 400-meter individual medley record and swam the last 50 meters of the freestyle leg faster than any man. Irish boxer Katie Taylor won her country's only gold medal as women competed in the ring for the first time. Team USA's 16-year-old gymnastics star Gabby Douglas became the first African-American to win the all-around title and the first U.S. athlete to win gold in both that event and the team competition. In fact, by dominating in gymnastics, swimming, soccer, basketball, and beach volleyball, ladies carry the American team's medal tally, said Tasneem Raja in MotherJones.com, with 56% of the total medals and 63% of the golds. Yes, it was a good 2 weeks for female athletes, said Mark Purdy in San Jose Mercury News, but their visibility won't last. At every Olympic Games, female athletes fill U.S. TV screens and then fall almost completely off the radar. Most people who watch women's Olympic sports on TV for the spectacle, storylines, and eye candy tune out once the games are over. As a result, attempts to establish professional women's leagues in soccer, volleyball, and other sports have mostly flopped. The Olympics do inspire girls to get involved in high school and college sports, but do they inspire them to buy tickets to watch other women play? Not yet. Even so, the 2012 Games represented a huge step forward for women's sports, said the Boston Globe in an editorial. For the first time in history, every country sent female athletes, even the most restrictive governments like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Bahrain. And don't forget Tamnina Kohistani of Afghanistan, the most inspiring athlete I met at these games, said Mike Wise in the Washington Post. A sprinter, she defied years of abuse and even death threats from men in her patriarchal country to compete in the 100-meter dash. My country will remember me forever, one day, she told reporters, some of whom wept as she told her harrowing story. Other girls will watch me and I will tell them, come run with me. Run with me, Tamina. The next article is called Campaign 2012, the Post-Truth Era. If politics had a referee, said Mona Claren in NationalReview.com, he'd blow his whistle and disqualify the Democrats for running the dirtiest, emptiest, and most deceptive campaign in memory. Harry Reid's made-up claims about Mitt Romney's taxes were bad enough, but this week the pro-Obama super PAC priorities, U.S. stooped even lower, with a TV ad effectively accusing Romney of murder. The ad features a laid-off steel worker, Joe Soptic, recounting how after Romney's Bain Capital closed his plant, he lost his family health insurance, causing his wife to not seek cancer treatment until it was too late. It's a sad tale, affectingly told, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The truth, however, is that the plant closed 2 years after Romney left Bain, and Mrs. Soptic died 5 years after the plant closed. Unable to run on his dismal record, a desperate Obama is now relying entirely on allegations about his opponent that bear no relation to the observable universe. It's hard to feel sorry for Romney, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com, since he's probably the most blatant liar who's ever run for president. Romney's post-truth campaign has made an art of splicing and editing Obama's speeches to distort his meaning and is now resorting to just baldly making up stuff. Romney's latest attack ad accuses Obama of trying to roll back welfare reform so that recipients would no longer have to work, a racially charged allegation without even the flimsiest basis in reality. Every independent fact-checker has ruled the ads a pants-on-fire lie. Romney is also charged that Obama was trying to keep military personnel from voting in Ohio, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com, and made a string of other transparently false claims. Clearly, Romney is convinced that there are no consequences for breathtaking dishonesty. In the super PAC era, dishonest attacks may be the norm rather than the exception, said Ellis Hennigan in Newsday. The Supreme Court has ruled that these new, well-funded attack groups can smear at will and do it anonymously. Why wouldn't they lie with impunity? Both Obama and Romney would seem to prefer mudslinging to really grappling with the things Americans rightly fear, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. As a direct result, voters are growing more cynical than ever, and we're becoming a nation that believes nothing, not in nothing, but nothing that we're told by anyone in supposed authority. And now let's take a look at a few short items as we reach the end of our program. The U.S. won 104 medals at the Olympic Games, the most of any country, but on a per capita basis, we rank just 50th in the world, with one medal per 3.4 million residents. First was tiny Grenada, which won a medal for every 104,000 residents. Jamaica, with 12 medals, was second on a per capita basis. More than 3 billion people on the planet are under the age of 25, the largest generation in human history. Even if these young people choose to have smaller families than their parents, the world's population will still rise from 7 billion now to 9.3 billion by 2050, the equivalent of adding another India and China to the world. And now let's take a look at our poll watch for this week. Despite a lot of negative publicity over pat-downs, 54% of Americans think the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, is doing a good or excellent job of security screening at airports. 42% say the TSA is doing a poor or fair job. And 25% say Chick-fil-A's opposition to gay marriage makes them more likely to eat at the chain restaurant, while 24% say they're less likely to do so. 43% say it really makes no difference to them. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long, until next time.